Now we shall begin. You should answer the questions as you listen, because you will not hear the recording a second time. Listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 5.
Good morning, Travel Link. How can I help you?
Good morning. I live in Bayswater and I'd like to get to Harbour City tomorrow before 11 a.m.
Well, to get to Bayswater...
No, I live in Bayswater. My destination is Harbour City.
Oh, sorry. Right, so that's Bayswater to Harbour City. Are you planning to travel by bus or train?
I don't mind, really. Whichever option is faster, I suppose.
Well, if you catch a railway express, that'll get you there in under an hour. Let's see. Yes, if you can make the 9:30 a.m. express, I'd recommend you do that.
Great. Which station does that leave from?
Hellendale is the nearest train station to you.
Did you say Helensvale?
No, Hellendale. That's Hellendale.
What's the best way to get to the Hellendale station, then?
Well, hang on a minute while I look into that. Now, it seems to me that you have two options. Option one would be to take the 706 bus from the Bayswater Shopping Centre to Central Street. When you get there, you transfer to another bus, which will take you to the station. Or the second option, if you don't mind walking a couple of kilometres, is to go directly to Central Street and get straight on the bus going to the train station.
OK. Which bus is that?
The 792 will take you to the station.
I guess the walk will be good for me, so that might be the better option. What time do I catch the 792?
There are two buses that should get you to the station on time. One just before 9 o'clock and one just after. But look, at that time of the morning, it might be better to take the earlier one, just in case there's a traffic jam or something. The 8:55 is probably safer than the 9:05.
Yeah, I don't want to miss the train, so I'll be sure to get on the 5 to 9 bus.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 6 to 10. Now listen and answer questions 6 to 10.
By the way, how much will I have to pay in fares?
Well, you can get a ticket on the bus for $1.80 cash, and you'll need $10 each way for the train. Wait, do you have a Travel Link card?
No, but I can get one before tomorrow.
OK, well, that'll make it considerably cheaper then. The bus will cost $1.50 each way, and the train will be... The train to Harbour City will... Still cost $10, because you'll be travelling during peak hours in the morning. So no savings there, I'm afraid. However, if you could come back at an off-peak time...
What does that mean?
Well, if you could start your return journey before 5 p.m. or later than 7:30 in the evening...
Actually, I wasn't planning on coming back till at least 8 o'clock anyway.
Oh, in that case, you can make quite a saving if you use your Travel Link card. You did say you were planning to purchase one, didn't you?
Yes, I'll pick one up later today.
Good. That would mean your return train journey would only cost you $7.15 with your card.
Thank you.
Is there anything else I can help you with?
Actually, there is. Do you know if I can use the Travel Link card on ferries?
If you're thinking of the Harbour City ferries that go back and forth between the North and South Bank, those are the commuter ferries, then yes. A one-way trip costs $4.50, but with your card you'd make a 20% saving and only pay $3.55.
So $3.55 for the commuter ferry. What about the tour boats?
You mean the tourist ferries that go upriver on sightseeing tours? No, they only take cash or credit card. They're not part of the Travel Link company.
Oh, I see. I don't suppose you know the cost of a tour.
In actual fact, I do, because I took a friend on the trip upriver just last week. We decided on the afternoon tour, and that was $35 each. But I understand that you can do the whole day for $65.
Thank you. You've been a great help.
My pleasure. Enjoy your day out.
That is the end of section one. You now have 30 minutes to check your answers. Section two. You will hear a guidance counsellor talking to a group of students. First, You have some time to look at questions 11 to 14. Listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 14.
Hello, everyone. I'm the counselling administrator here at St Ives College, and I've been asked to come and talk to you about our counselling team and the services that we offer. We have three professional counsellors here at St Ives: Louise Bagshaw, Tony Denby, and Naomi Flynn. They each hold daily one-on-one sessions with students, but which counsellor you see will depend on a number of factors. If you've never used a counsellor before, then you should make an appointment with Naomi Flynn. Naomi specialises in seeing new students and offers a preliminary session where she will talk to you about what you can expect from counselling, followed by some simple questions about what you would like to discuss. This can be really helpful for students who are feeling a bit worried about the counselling process. Naomi is also the best option for students who can only see a counsellor outside office hours. She is not in on Mondays, but starts early on Wednesday mornings and works late on Thursday evenings, so you can see her before your first class or after your last class on those days. Louise staffs our drop-in centre throughout the day. If you need to see someone without a prior appointment, then she is the one to visit. Please note that if you use this service, then Louise will either see you herself or place you with the next available counsellor. If you want to be sure to see the same counsellor on each visit, then we strongly recommend you make an appointment ahead of time. You can do this at reception during office hours or by using our online booking form. Tony is our newest addition to the counselling team. He is our only male counsellor, and he has an extensive background in stress management and relaxation techniques. We encourage anyone who is trying to deal with anxiety to see him. Tony will introduce you to a full range of techniques to help you cope with this problem, such as body awareness, time management, and positive reinforcement.
Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 15 to 20. Now listen and answer questions 15 to 20.
Each semester, the counselling team runs a number of small group workshops. These last for 2 hours and are free to all enrolled students. Our first workshop is called Adjusting. We've found that tertiary education can come as a big shock for some people. After the structured learning environment of school, it is easy to feel lost. In this workshop, we will introduce you to what is necessary for academic success. As you might expect, we're targeting first-year students with this offering. Getting organised follows on from the first workshop. Here, we're going to help you break the habit of putting things off, get the most out of your time, and discover the right balance between academic and recreational activities. With Getting Organised, we're catering to a broader crowd, which includes all undergraduates and postgraduates. Next up is a workshop called Communicating. The way people interact here may be quite different to what you're used to, especially if you've come from abroad. We'll cover an area that many foreign students struggle with: how to talk with teachers and other staff. We'll cover all aspects of multicultural communication. International students tend to get a lot out of this class, so we particularly encourage you to come along. But I must say that sometimes students from a local background find it helpful too. So, everyone is welcome. The anxiety workshop is held later on in the year and deals with something you will all be familiar with: the nerves and anxiety that come when exams are approaching. Many students go through their entire academic careers suffering like this, but you don't have to. Come to this workshop and we'll teach you all about relaxation and how to breathe properly, as well as meditation and other strategies to remain calm. We've tailored this workshop to anyone who is going to sit exams. Finally, we have the motivation workshop. The big topic here is how to stay on target and motivated during long-term research projects. This workshop is strictly for research students, as less advanced students already have several workshops catering to their needs. Well, that's it. Thanks for your time. If you have any questions or want more information about our services, do come and see us at the counselling service.
That is the end of section two. You now have half a minute to check your answers.
You will hear a conversation between two students working on a presentation. You have 30 seconds to look at questions 21 to 24.
Hey Chris, thanks for coming. Are you ready to practice our presentation for tomorrow?
Yeah, just give me a moment to switch on my laptop. There we go. Okay, what do you think?
Wow, that actually looks really nice. Well done.
So I've put the title up here in the middle, Reasons People Move Out of Their Parents' Homes. I thought we could start with the general graph outlining why people fly the nest at any age, and then we could break it down to age groups and social or ethnic backgrounds before we get into how our findings fit into what sociologists say about leaving your parents' house and what the effects of the timing and the circumstances of your decision can be.
That sounds good to me. So we can start with the bar chart here. Do you think they'll be able to read the tiny letters here?
No, which is why we'll have to read them out to them.
Okay. So we could take turns then. I'd start with bar A, which says that the number one reason that young people leave home is to go to college or university.
Exactly. And then I'd go on to the second bar, which gives the number of people who said they felt smothered by their parents' control over their lives and decided to get their own house to avoid that.
Right. Then in bar C, we've got people who found a job and decided that it was a good opportunity to move away because of their new income.
Yep, and then those who didn't feel exactly smothered by their parents per se, but more so because of the lack of room in their parents' house and the fact that their parents were around pretty much 90% of the time.
Maybe we should move this bar so that it can be next to bar B, since they seem to be quite similar to each other.
Well, actually, that's why I kept them separate. But maybe you're right. They would lead smoothly into one another. So that means that jobs will now be bar D and bar E.
Bar E is about those who moved because of their partner or spouse.
Right. And then at the end, we've got those who were pushed to leave by their parents and those who left because of a conflict at home.
I guess at this point, we should mention that, as expected, we had almost zero people reply that they left home because of emancipation or abuse, despite the fact that our study was conducted anonymously. Probably because the participants didn't feel confident enough to share such private details with us. Or maybe just because there was no one in our pool of participants with such experiences.
Yeah.
You now have 30 seconds to look at questions 25 to 29.
So then we can break it down to age groups and show these four different graphs for our four age groups. Under 18s, 18 to 20, 21 to 24 and 25 and above.
Shall we take the graphs by age, or should we start with the second group? What do you think? Because we haven't got that much data on under-18s. And starting with 25 and above would also feel a bit strange to me, seeing as it was our second smallest group, and most participants were between 18 and 24 when they moved out of their parents' home.
Yeah, you're right. Perhaps we should start with our two biggest groups and then move on to the other two.
So, you can present 18 to 20, and I can present 21 to 24. And then we can maybe present the other two groups together.
I think it's best if we present them separately, since the findings are so different.
Yeah, I guess you're right. So, I can present the under-18s, and you can present the 25 and over.
Perfect. Or, wait, should we do it the other way round, so it flows more naturally?
Yeah, sure. And then we can include a brief note at the end for those who haven't moved out yet.
Yeah, great.
You now have 30 seconds to look at question 30.
Excellent. So, then we can move on to the final chart before we get to the bibliography and explain what they said they found difficult when they moved out.
Yeah, so we can say the biggest issue for everyone was finding a place to live, especially for those who didn't have a guarantor or didn't live in a student hall of residence.
Yes, and that 30% of the participants also experienced some financial problems in the beginning, with bills and rent and food and everything.
Right. Then an even larger number reported that they didn't expect to miss their family that much, but ended up visiting their parents' home often just to see them and spend some time with them.
Although, we should probably cut that number down a notch to exclude those who went back home just so their parents could cook and do their laundry for them.
Yeah. Sure. Anyway, then we should finish off with the final issue, which was flatmates.
Oh, yeah. So we should say that a whopping 67% complained about the people they had to live with and that they were often dirty and inconsiderate.
Right. Great. So then we can move on to how our findings fit into...
You will hear a biology lecture about tubularia. You have 30 seconds to look at questions 31 to 33.
Hello, everyone. I'm glad so many people have shown up here today to hear about these fascinating little creatures called the Turbellaria. My name is Dr. Baker, and I've spent 20 years researching thousands of different species of platyhelminths, what are commonly known as flatworms, both free-living and parasitic. So there are a lot of things I could tell you about these extremely interesting invertebrate, but I will try to keep it short. Turbellaria are unique amongst flatworms in three ways. The first one is that, unlike 80% of all platyhelminths, Turbellaria do not need to secure nourishment from a living source. This means that they do not generally parasitize a host, but are instead found living freely in the environment. So, no need to worry about any of these little samples I've got here escaping and causing havoc. The second way in which they're different is that they are, well, they're incredibly simple. And by simple, I don't mean in terms of structure, as their structure is indeed quite complex, and I'll get to that later. By simple, I mean that they're not the brightest bulbs in the box. Flatworms in general are not known for their cognitive abilities, especially when compared with other invertebrates such as cuttlefish or octopuses or even insects. But amongst flatworms, Turbellaria are by far the most primitive of the bunch. Finally, and this is a direct result of the first thing I mentioned, turbellaria tend to have a much more complicated sensory system in their head region. This includes a set of eyes with receptors that can detect light, as well as chemical sensory organs that assist turbellaria in locating food. Obviously, as other flatworms receive nutrition directly from their host, they have no need for this.
You now have 30 seconds to look at questions 34 to 38.
Despite these three differences, however, turbellaria are quite similar to other flatworms in all sorts of other ways. First of all, as their name suggests, they're incredibly flat, which allows them to hide under stones. They're symmetrical on both sides, and they don't have a body cavity. They also don't have any specialized respiratory, skeletal, and circulatory systems. What they do have, however, and this is what I meant when I referenced their structure before, is three layers known as the endoderm, the mesoderm, and the ectoderm, as well as a head region where their brain and sense organs are located, and a spongy connective tissue that fills all the space between their organs. Finally, like most species of flatworms, they're hermaphrodites. This means that a single flatworm has a set of each gender. But don't take this to mean they reproduce alone. Their preferred method of reproduction is called cross-fertilization, which means that each flatworm fertilizes the other. I mentioned before that most flatworms need a host, but turbellaria feed from the environment. So what do they feed on? Most turbellaria can be found either in fresh or salt water, and they feed on small insects, microscopic matter, and crustaceans. They will pretty much eat anything they find. They have no preference on whether their food is living or dead. Also, and this is the most remarkable part about their eating habits. If they ever find themselves in a situation where food is scarce, they might also feed on themselves. That's right, they'll start eating their own body, starting with the least essential muscles and organs and working their way up. They will shrink in size until they're able to find food again, at which point they'll begin to regenerate everything they've lost. One final thing about food, and apologies in advance if I disgust you, turbellaria don't possess an anus, which means that their mouth, which is a muscular opening on the underside of their body, has to serve as one.
You now have 30 seconds to look at questions 39 to 40.
Before I finish this presentation, one more thing you've probably heard before but weren't sure if it was a myth or not. I mentioned already that turbellaria can reproduce on their own, but there's a second method they can use, which is known as fission. Now, as a child, you were probably told that if you cut a worm in half, it will grow into two new worms. That's not entirely true, but flatworms are not worms exactly, and they do have the ability to regenerate by splitting into two, perhaps even more smaller parts, at which point each part regrows the missing organs and becomes a brand new turbellarian. Now this is extremely important for us, and this is how I'd like to close this presentation, because their ability to regenerate endlessly makes them virtually immortal, and it might open pathways to regeneration in human cells or slowing the human aging process, which is why scientists like myself have been studying these unique creatures, hoping to get some answers. Thank you for listening, and please come along to see me and my samples if you have any further questions.